Houston, 90.1 FM.
This is Hank Rubichek, producer and lead host of Suck Bunch of Story, the only show in Houston devoted to storytelling. We're coming up next. You know, since 2008, we've brought you over 500 storytellers. Folks just like you. Ordinary people with extraordinary stories to tell. In fact, our show is a perfect example of community radio, and not by accident, we air on Houston's community station, KPFT. And we want to stay on the air for a very long time. And that's where you come in, because we're in a major fund drive, a KPFT fund drive. But you know what? We also need to know what shows move you. And I'm hoping the stories on our shows, stories about lives, despair, jubilation and tragedy, the peak of happiness, the incapacitating feeling of fear, folk tales and fairy tales peppered in to prove that there's always a dragon among us and a bully and a friend. Stories so raw and real, so rich. And when you give your donation either by calling 713-526-5738, option one, or online at kpft.org, I want you to scroll to So What's Your Story as a show that you like to see stick around. When moved by the stories, you move others with you. And remember, even if a story doesn't end happily, it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. It is 6 p.m. Wednesday, and you have tuned into award-winning So What's Your Story, the only show in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling. You're going to find it only here at KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's community station, or kpft.org. I am your host, Hank Rubichek, and each week, along with Mary Edgerton, Eric Keane, and Larry Thompson, we bring you the best in community radio, and we must be doing something right, because thanks to your support, we've been doing it for 14 years. You know, it's no hyperbole when we claim that each week we spotlight ordinary people with extraordinary stories to tell, and today, my guest storyteller personifies that claim. Born in Louisiana and raised in Alabama during the Civil Rights era, Wayne Lynch grew up with great respect for country and the Constitution and joined the Army in 1980 and served with nuclear artillery during the Cold War. He returned to school after the war, became a CPA, and then completed a law degree from South Texas College of Law. He spent most of his career in Galveston County, where he continues to live and maintain a part-time tax practice. But today, we journey through Wayne's storytelling persona, one which emerged after his mother's death in 2001. I've had the good fortune of listening to Wayne's raw, authentic style at our Houston Storytellers Story Swaps, and I think that you're going to enjoy him too. Wayne, welcome. I'm glad that we can finally do this. I know we've been talking about this for a while.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Hank.
Looking forward to it. Okay, Wayne, the stories that you've selected for today represent your interest in your ancestors and early American history. And the stories that we're going to hear come from a single family line named Thurman. Your first story, Old Joseph Thurman of Bedford County, Virginia, kicks it off pretty well. Tell us the story.
All right. Thank you very much for the introduction. This is the story of my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, Joseph Thurman, and he's the starting point. But the truth is, I've been working on just how best to tell this man's story for years, and I can't quite come up with the right spin on him. I mean, he's the very foundation upon which our entire Thurman line is based, and the most outstanding thing I know about old Joseph is the part where he bit off the nose of William Hudnall while settling a dispute between the two men. But that gets ahead. Let's go further back. We first find old Joseph in Bedford County, Virginia, around 1790. He was already in trouble chasing after Nancy Franklin. She was the young daughter of one Mary Ann Franklin. I don't know all the details, but it seems obvious that Mary Ann did not take to Joseph right away. Instead, she swore out a peace bond against him for good behavior. But Joseph, he hung in there. And some 4 years later, he married little Nancy. She got pregnant with great-grandpa Jabez right away and had three youngins in the first 5 years of their marriage. Old Joseph, he could never get along with anybody. And he soon got into a fight with that aforementioned William Hudnall. This was a prior incident, and it resulted in jail time. Unless Joseph could put up a yet another peace bond, which he did, but only with help, he needed friends. Robert Craig and William Dadney signed for him and put up the money. Now, unfortunately, that peace only lasted for 2 months. And in May of 1797, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, Joseph got into another fight with William Hudnall. This time, he bit off the man's nose. You know, in those days, particularly in frontier counties, holding a man in jail was extremely brutal, and they didn't like doing it. And all most counties could afford was a calaboose, and that's little more than a cage. They resented the cost of feeding their prisoners and usually made the families do it. And maybe that's why Joseph's bail was continued, and he remained free until the trial came up in August. But, you know, there's another reason we don't think about today for his lenient treatment. Folks in those days were accustomed to some pretty serious personal fights. You know, gouging an eyeball or fish hooking, or in this case, biting off the occasional nose, just didn't raise that many eyebrows. Tensions ran high at the trial. Joseph had a hard time controlling his temper. He argued and swore so much in front of the jury, the judge fined him 50 cents. Said he counted 22 curses, and that was hard on Joseph. He was getting worked up. He's arguing so hard, and he wasn't having any success. He could see public opinion was against him, and a possible jail term did seem imminent. So off he went, running into the night with Nancy and their children, and old Mary Ann went too. Over the mountains and down the great valley of Virginia, they went to East Tennessee. You know, back in Bedford County, the two sureties, Craig and Dabney, they must have had some really serious influence in that county because their bond was dismissed even though he ran. The men avoided their liability. You know, I sometimes think to myself that getting Joseph Thurman out of Virginia was really all the peace Bedford County needed. Now, over in Blount County, Tennessee, Joseph started on his new life. He's no longer hampered by a bad reputation. Joseph now established himself as an upstanding citizen. While raising the young family, he served on a few juries. In 1803, he got himself elected as the constable for his district, probably a mistake. He couldn't change his own nature, and Joseph soon was broiled in yet another lawsuit, this time with a man named William Cowan. Well, Joseph got lucky, though. Well, maybe. Maybe he makes his own luck. I don't know. Before the trial concluded, Mr. Cowan up and died. His sons tried to appeal the case, but without Cowan's testimony, it was dismissed. Joseph's time as constable came to a quick end also. He was reprimanded again for cursing and dismissed after being on the job for only 4 months. You know, I have no way at this point of knowing who done what and why, but before the year was out, while that term would have still been running for constable, Joseph died. Now, I don't know if that's the Cowan boys collecting on their debts, or maybe another of Joseph's friendly acquaintances killed him. Well, he could have had an accident, too. But in any event, his very modest estate got sold for debts, and his children were apprenticed to a local businessman. My own great-grandfather, Jabez, only 9 years old at the time, went to a man named Pat Fitzgerald who promised to learn him to read and write and learn the tailor's trade. And he did. Some folks think Nancy later married that Mr. Fitzgerald. She was, after all, still a young woman in her 20s. And, you know, she still had plenty of time to bear some more children. And in those days, that was important. They would be Fitzgerald kids, though, and not Thurman's. And so old Joseph Thurman, the man who bit off the nose of William Hudnall, became the foundation upon which my ancestor Thurmans built their fine family reputation. And as time and stories go by, I'm afraid we might notice a certain theme running through that Thurman family line. You know, there's something of a bad seed. It's going to skip a generation here and there, but it still manages to resurface a long time in the next one.
Bad seeds are okay. Bad seeds are okay, Wayne. Let me ask you, what is it about your mother's death that really triggered your interest in doing the family research that eventually, ultimately came with these stories?
Well, you know, I was always a history buff, and I dig into it pretty deep at times. Then when Mom died, I had written her will, and because I'm a lawyer. And when she asked me what I wanted, I told her that all I really needed was all her notes from her genealogy research that she had done for 30 years. She did it the old fashioned way. She actually went these places, talked to people.
Yeah.
I have old recordings.
Wow. Yeah. One of my favorite plays is I Never Sing for My Father by Robert Anderson. And there was a line in there where he says, death ends a life, but it doesn't end a relationship. And I think that that's exactly what these stories do. And that's a wonderful point. That's a wonderful point. Your next yarn is Jabez and Sons. Anything we need to know before you tell the story?
Oh, I would just kind of note that, we're running through this chronological, mm-hmm. several generations of the Thurmans. You don't need to know anything to enjoy these stories except just that.
Right. That's kind. Yeah, because our listeners don't like to think. We just like to tune in because, this is at 6 o'clock. We are fighting traffic. We don't want to hear the other stuff. We want to hear Wayne Lynch. So we like that. All right, let's hear it.
All right, let's talk about Jabez, though. If old Joseph Thurman was the family foundation, then Jabez, he's our cornerstone. He's the complete opposite of his father. Jabez lived in East Tennessee, mostly around Knoxville, his entire life, which, by the way, was a very impressive 96 years. He married one of the Tipton girls, daughter of the famous Fighting Billy Tipton of the Revolutionary War. And that marriage started a tradition of Thurmans marrying Tiptons. It eventually gets so tangled up, I heard one of the later family genealogists committed suicide. Yeah, just as old Joseph Thurman looks like a bad seed in the family tree, Jabez Thurman feels like one of the good guys. Proud to have him in the family. No questionable tidbits, no bad stories, just a family man who raised 11 children. Watch most of them leave home on their way west, seeking fortune and new land. First wife Nancy died soon after the ninth child and left Jabez to check out the local prospects. There weren't really any true Tipton girls available at that point, at least none that wanted to take on a pack of nine kids. So Jabez married himself a Tipton widow. Her name was Alcee, and she had been married to Nancy's cousin, Reuben, so she already had a relationship with them kids. They had two boys of their own, one of which was Uncle Henry Carrick Thurman, whose Civil War story we'll hear in a few minutes. But for now, the two oldest boys was Patrick and Joe. They both came into the world between 1920 and 1925, and I don't even really know which one came out first. I do know which one left home first, and that would be Uncle Patrick, because Joe, he's my great-granddad back down the line. But like I said, Patrick left home first. Around 18 and 40, he fell under the spell of a pretty young Tipton girl, a cousin of his, of course. I don't remember all the details. I do know that things went badly, and Patrick got really jealous. He killed a rival suitor, and unfortunately is also a cousin named Tipton. And then he ran off in the middle of the night, heading out for the young Republic of Texas. Once there, Patrick joined the Meyer expedition and invaded Mexico with the Texans in 1841. Fought again in the Mexican War a few years later. When Patrick mustered out the second time, he headed to California because the gold rush was on, and he disappeared. Joe left home a few years after Patrick. Jabez didn't like it none, and they had a terrible row. It ended up getting Joe getting tossed out of the Baptist church there in Knoxville because he refused to come forward and repent, so they disowned him. Instead, Joe joined his father-in-law, also named Tipton, moving west to Missouri. In fact, the fight itself was likely about Joe leaving Tennessee. Later in life, Joe was considered very clannish. He had kept the family very close and preached a lot about loyalty. He likely got that from Jabez. Throughout his whole 96 years, Jabez always kept up with his children, even long after they had left home. In fact, that's how I happened to come about most of these stories. It's from those letters. But back in our story, yeah, that's right, Joe had picked another Tipton girl, and things did not really go well for them. Elizabeth got pregnant in the spring, and they were happy, but then she died in February of 47, just 4 days after giving birth. Joe said, "Elizabeth suffered more than anybody I ever saw. She lay 2 days and nights with her arm around my neck trying to talk to me." The baby did live, but another son named Jonathan then took sick the very night Elizabeth died, and he lasted 2 more weeks. But then threw himself out of the bed in convulsions and also died soon after. It was a very sad time for Joe. He became convinced that Missouri was very sickly, and he advised the rest of the family to remain in Tennessee. But times get better. And in 48, Joe met Miss Mary Jane Dusenberry. Her family lived in the neighboring county, and the pair were soon married. She is 23, and Joe is a couple of years older. Their first child came in November of that same year. And by the 1850 census, Mary was raising three of Elizabeth's children along with two babies of her own. And there would be four more. My great-grandpa Bill Thurman was the one born in 1850. I think he got the bad seed. Joe and Patrick weren't saints. But the obnoxious reputation first established by original Joseph Thurman definitely returned two generations later in Bill and his offspring. But, you know, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. For now, around 1852, and back into Jabez, he was worried about his migrating children. It took him 10 years, but Jabez had finally got the charges dropped on Patrick. You know, some say the man never really died and that he forgave his cousin Patrick. You know, I'm not certain, but I do know that nobody in the family had any word of Patrick since he had left Texas. He is lost in California. Jabez wanted Joe to go find him. After all, I said Joseph was the foundation, Jabez the cornerstone. Well, you know, that's going to make Joe the glue that held the Thurman clan together out west. And so Joe set out to find Patrick. Joe was not a tall man, but he was strong and stout with sky blue eyes and long blonde hair. His granddaughter described him riding across the fields with hair streaming behind him like George Armstrong Custer, except, of course, nobody yet knew George Armstrong Custer. He was just an upstart cavalryman. Joe loved his horses, and he took off riding across the plains through Oklahoma, Colorado, Nevada, and then to California. He rode fast and hard. He had two horses with him, riding one while the other ran alongside for spare. Joe was very familiar with Indians. He had traded often across the Missouri border in the nations. And I don't think he was ever tested on the way to California. At least there's no story passes down to us about meeting up with any of the Western tribes. He did get to California. He poked around for a few months. He found Patrick in Jackson City, right in the heart of the gold country. They didn't find gold. Joe wrote that money was hard to make in that country, and everyone should stay home as long as they can still get Bud and never start to California. And so the brothers came home. They came home a different route than the one they had taken. Instead, they went through the Isthmus of Panama, and they took a steamship. And then they walked across the Isthmus of Panama and took another steamship up to New Orleans, where then it came about that they, you know, rode on up back to southwest Missouri and home to the family. When they got there, little Lena, one of the daughters, she tells this story. She says, me and all the kids, we got up underneath the floorboards. There was two men approaching, strangers. And we were all down there whispering and talking about how we was going to rob them men. But you know what? About that time I looked up, and there was my old pappy. He was reaching down through the floorboards and yanked me up. And there he was. Yeah. And there he was, my daddy, old Joe. The kids then met Patrick. They had never met him before, and they never probably really would again. I'm not really sure what happens with Patrick. And somewhere along that time, he passes on into history, and we don't really ever hear from him again. They say that he might be the same Patrick Thurman that was with the 6th Tennessee and near Sparta, Mississippi, in the Civil War, got killed while he was on picket duty. They think that that might be the very same fella because, you know, the Thurmans, they did all fight for the North. There wasn't really any Thurmans that fought for the South except old Joe. And that was really just happenstance because, you know, they was at home in Fort Worth and he got caught up in the home militia there in Fort Worth. I could talk about Joe Thurman all day, but, you know, we've pretty much got to move this story on down. So, let's move on forward, and we'll get.
I'm glad. Yeah. Well, I'm glad. I'm certainly glad you told this one. So let me understand you. We've gone from a bad seed to a good seed, but the bad seed killed a rival suitor. Did I hear that right?
Well, yeah.
You got some interesting seeds in your family. Yeah. Well, my great grandfather lived to be 103. He was. I don't know if you'd call him a good seed or bad seed, but he was a weird seed, a fun seed. And he smoked two packs of cigarettes a day. So I don't know. I don't know what it requires to get that kind of longevity. But I think that your family found some kind of magic formula. Carrick and Sinde, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, yes, okay. That's how he says it.
It's a Civil War story. And I remember your Civil War story, and we got this clarified. This is the one that we were talking about. This is the one you told the swap several months ago.
That's right. I
love the story. Let's hear it, Wayne.
All right. Right now, I want to tell a story about old Uncle Carrick. When the Civil War broke out, Henry Carrick Thurman was just 22 years old. He's a son of Jabez. He grew up near Knoxville on some land just outside of Cades Cove, which is now a state park in Tennessee. At that time, he was already married to a young lady named Lucinda, Sinde, who was just 20 years old herself. They already had a four-month-old baby boy. A couple of years into the war, late spring of 62, and Carrick signed on with the 6th Regiment of East Tennessee Volunteers. They were a Union outfit that was recruiting in the area. Carrick didn't serve alone, neither, as his brother Reuben signed up right alongside. Had another brother named James who served with the regiment over in Missouri. And then there was my grandpappy Joe, who had taken his family down to Texas to get away from the war. And he ended up serving briefly in a Confederate outfit as just home soldiers. But during the war itself, Lucinda, who Carrick did call Sinde, stayed with his folks, Jabez and Alcee, on their farm near Knoxville. Now, that was hard times for the people at home. Jabez was over 65 and already too old for farming. Carrick told Sinde to keep all of my stock together and save my two mares if you can. You had better stay with father and mother until I return, for they are your best friends, and they will help you all they can. Carrick's regiment saw its first service in the Appalachian Mountains, protecting the Cumberland Gap from use by the Confederates. Now, unfortunately, that left Knoxville and Cades Cove deep inside rebel territory. And for the next year, the 6th Tennessee stayed in Kentucky, West Virginia. They was working to keep the pass open and the rebels out of the north. They weren't keeping them out of Tennessee, though. And at some point, Carrick was captured, and he got to be what we called a parole prisoner. You know, early in the war, things was more friendly. And when soldiers surrendered, they signed a promise not to fight anymore unless they were exchanged for a prisoner from the other side. And that's just what happened. He was at the end of the year, 1862, Carrick got exchanged for some captured Reb and returned to his regiment. Times were tough. Back at home, Rebs were squeezing the people for all they could get. You know, Lucinda says, I have put in a small crop, and I intend to plow it and make me and Johnny some bread to eat. When the Yankees come, and I want the Yankees to come in here before the crops are made, the Rebs will take all that the people could make if they come first. She also closed with an admission that Carrick should pray, for we are in great danger. That danger passed, and she wrote again about 6 weeks later, and it was mid-June. She says, I am at your father's yet. I intend to stay there until you get home. Johnny is as sassy as a pet pig, and I have taken his titty from him a short time back. He is doing very well. There was some sad news. My grandfather is dead. Old Mr. Durand is dead. And there were several more that she listed off people that had died. At the end, I enclose you a lock of mine and Johnny's hair, and I want you to send me a lock of your hair to remember you. Sinde's letter stopped getting through after that. Carrick worried himself into a state of great trouble about the Rebs going to East Tennessee. He hoped and speculated that all the trouble would soon end. He said, in the last 6 days, we gave them Rebs the worst whooping that men ever got in the world. This is the largest fight that will ever be fought during this war, Sinde. I don't know about that. Carrick closed his letter with some words to his brother. He was feeling pretty patriotic about this time. He says, Tyler, you must stay with father, and you and Sinde must try to do the best you can and take care of father and mother and the baby, and I will try to keep the Rebs beat back out of East Tennessee. I consider our freedom worth as much as gold. That's why Carrick was fighting, I guess, for his freedom. I don't know. Carrick was talking about, of course, the battles around Chattanooga and Missionary Ridge there in Tennessee. They were big battles, but he didn't have any idea what was still coming. Christmas that year was bleak time for Lucinda. On the 27th, of December, she took the opportunity to write a few lines and let Carrick know we are well. But she had some other opinions for him. I received your letter yesterday, and I was glad to hear from you and to hear that you was well. Carrick, I don't want you to join the army anymore. Rube wrote that they was a heap of boys joined the army again for 3 years. I don't want you, whatever you do, to join no more. Your mother says you must not. Carrick, if you do, you had better not. I want you to try to get off and come home if you can. I know you can if you will try, and I want you to try. I am tired of living without you. And she went on. I was at home Christmas by myself. What would I have given to have you with me? Things quieted down after that. Rebs left East Tennessee. Lucinda managed to visit Carrick's camp for a few days. She had time with him before the regiment marched off south. That young couple had been apart mostly for like 20 consecutive months, and their visit came just in time because Carrick was soon to march off south. Cindy had premonitions of death and disaster. She says, if I don't get to see you before going down to Georgie, and if we should never meet again anymore on earth, I hope that we will meet in heaven where parting shall be no more. And then she says, your little son John talks and cries about you every day since you left home and wants to see you very bad. He will stand in the door and call for you every day. Those campaigns around Atlanta dragged on for months. They had similar letters back and forth. Carrick saw heavy fighting at Kennesaw Mountain and then again at Atlanta. He says, Cindy, I have got through safe this far. I am going to try to come home just as soon as this fight is over, if God spares my life. God did spare Carrick at that time, but he did not get a pass home. Instead, they marched across Georgia to Savannah and then to South Carolina. His last two letters from Cindy spoke of a mysterious illness. She says, I have been sick for the last 3 or 4 weeks, but I'm getting well. I have not been well since I went to see you at the Plains. The doctor said riding on the cars was the cause of it. But I think if you could come home, it would cure me, for I am very near dead to see you. At this news, Carrick worried himself sick. He sent a letter directly home to his parents for more details about Cindy, he says, and a few days later, the mystery was solved. A second letter came from Cindy, and she says, it was something like the fever. Rogers come and give me some medicine, so I have got well again. The doctor was afraid that I would miscarry. And just like that, hope returned to Carrick's world. She is a little bit tricky. Not only was Cindy pregnant, but the family's claim for what the Yanks took from us got approved. And she even hoped, we will have you some honey when you come home. We hid 3 jars from them, and we have got 7. Later that fall, she even spoke of the peaches getting ripe, and I wish you was here to help us eat peaches and watermelons. Johnny is the prettiest little boy you ever saw, and he's fat as a pig, and he wants to see you so bad. Carrick's next letter brought tough news for the area, for the whole region, really. His regiment found itself transferring east to join back up with General Sherman. They were traveling by rail through Harper's Ferry, Virginia, when they had a terrible train wreck. Carrick says the cars flew off the track and the car that our company was in upset and dragged along some distance and mighty near mashed up the company. It was caused by a wheel giving out. Hiram Davis fell out of the car and got stove all to pieces. He died in 10 minutes after he fell out. Alfred Kine got tore all to pieces. Also, John Coker got both arms broke, and he went on and on and on. All the neighbors had been joined up together and now they were hurt together. The train wreck ended all talk of moving the regiment further south, and Carrick remained in Washington, D.C. with his injured friends. Even though he survived the wreck itself, while recovering in the hospital, Carrick caught pneumonia and died on April the 15th of 1865. That's actually 6 days after General Robert E. Lee had surrendered the last major Confederate army and ended the war. So, like so many other Civil War soldiers, Henry Carrick Thurman did not return to Lucinda and the babies.
The Civil War. I love that story. I love that story, Wayne. My wife's great-great-grandmother saved a number of letters written to her by Union soldiers wanting to court her. And, you know, they're incredible letters. They really are. And there's something about the Civil War that makes it romantic. I know it's a tough question to ask, and I'm not sure either one of us is going to come up with an answer in 60 seconds or less, but what makes the Civil War so romantic?
I think it is so romantic because the reality of it is that it's such a disaster and so sad. Yeah. And yet throughout that, people are still living their lives and still falling in love.
Yeah.
I think it's the intensity yeah. of the times.
Yeah. Well, that's a great answer. When I was born, when I got interested in the Civil War years later, I wanted to find out when the last veteran died, which was in 1953. And I was born in 1952. And I remember talking to my class, it was a public speaking class, where they had to do informative speeches. And I said, and I don't know what got me talking about the Civil War, but I said, I mean, obviously I'm not that old of a guy. And here's a person, I showed his picture, who was still alive when I was born. And they looked at me and they said, you're such a funny guy, Dr. Rubichev. That's really great. They didn't believe me. They thought the Civil War was during medieval times. But I think there's something to that as well. It obviously wasn't in our lifetime, but it was, I don't know, close enough where it resonates some ways. I don't know.
Oh, I think our generation is much closer to it.
Our generation?
Yeah. Our generation. Yeah, sure. Well, I'm a few years younger than you, but I think
everybody's younger than me. Yeah. Right.
It's getting that. It gets more and more every day, doesn't it?
That's right. This is Hank Rubichev, and you've been listening to my guest storyteller, Wayne Lynch, on Soap, What's Your Story? Only on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Wayne, you're a member of our guilds, Houston Storytellers Guild, and I know that you agree that we have a bunch of supportive tellers, and they really come from all over the place, and we'd love to have all of you listeners join us as well. We meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 Central Time. Our next one is June 27th. All you have to do is go to www.houstonstorytellers.org. We have that on our Facebook page. Under events on the menu, and you're going to find the Zoom link to the monthly swaps. You can also take your story skills to the next level by joining the Texas Storytelling Association or the National Storytelling Network. And our friends at the Moth sponsor theme-centered storytelling at Warehouse Live, the second Tuesday of the month. And also, if you have any suggestions for guests on this show, please shoot me an email at swys@kpft.org. Wayne, your next story is Bill and Effie. We need anything to know about these characters?
Oh, I'm going to tell you right off.
All right. Let's jump into it, my friend.
All right. Great-grandpa Bill Thurman. He's the oldest son of Joe Thurman and second wife, Mary Jane Dusenberry. He was born in Jasper County, Missouri, around 1850. And, of course, that means he saw Indians, the Civil War, Missouri guerrillas, and they were right in the heart of what we now know as Bleeding Kansas. This is Bill's upbringing. He's at 10 years old. Young Bill sassed a Yankee officer and earned himself a lifetime scar across his forehead from the back of a saber. Maybe that's the incident that made him mean and resentful, or maybe all the violence he witnessed. Or as I tend to believe, maybe he inherited that family bad seed from old Joseph Thurman. I'm not sure. I know this much. I never heard much good about the man. I'm so sorry to say. In the words of his granddaughter, Grandpa was about 5'10", black hair, brown eyes, dark ruddy skin. He was always fat, with square, fat, and stubby hands and feet and a loud voice, constantly bragging about his horses who could race any horse in six counties. Bill gambled, he chased women, and he was a hard drinker. But above all else, he would trade anything he had for a horse, or just a chance to bet on one. Bill loved to hunt, fish, and swap yarns, and never worked a day in his life if he could help it. His wife and children were literally born to wait on him. He went to Brackettville twice a year to buy supplies, and he had plenty of money, but he always gambled most of it away and came home broke and riding behind a borrowed mule team after having traded off his own horses. Bill was married to Miss Effie Johnson, the daughter of Kindred Johnson, who they met while the family was living in Eastland County, around Central Texas. She is the complete opposite of Bill. Maybe that's what attracted her. Otherwise, I have no idea why she would have married a man like him, but she was of Scotch-Irish stock, tall and slim. Effie had light skin, light brown hair, gray eyes, and weighed about 135 pounds. Just as Grandpa Bill's hands were fat and stubby, Effie's hands were slim with long fingers. Effie was educated. She could read and write quite well. She tried to teach the children. She had 6 books her mother had given her, and one of them was the Bible. She read a chapter every night out loud if she could get the children to listen. Her favorite expression around the house was, "Bless my soul, what are you into now?" When she got old, Grandma Effie had a small iron bed that she slept on. I understand the Quigg family out in West Texas still has it. Before she died, my mother and father stayed with her and Grandpa. Mama took care of her. Mama would put me on the bed next to Grandma, but against the wall so I wouldn't fall off while she did the housework. Grandma said she wanted me to have the bed, and she also pinned a fine gold pin with little shells on my baby dress and put a cameo that had no mounting in Mama's hand for me. You know, I still have them both. Grandpa Bill, he sold the gold cameo mounting on one of his trips to Brackettville. That's why it didn't mount. Bill remarried after Grandma's death. They had 2 more children. He was already about 60 years old, lazier than ever. That poor woman died from hard work and waiting on him. You know, there's a lot of tidbits about Bill and Effie, none that really are going to change their story. So what we're going to move on to is the great Thurman and Zuber Bueller feud that took place right after the turn of the century. Okay.
And in the words of your grandma, to show her respect, bless my soul, with this Thurman name. This one is, as you said, Thurman and Zuber Bueller?
Yes.
The West Texas feud. All right, as you just said. Let's hear it.
Let's hear it. You know, the Thurmans came to Edwards County in 1882. And just about the same time, Judge Roy Bean had arrived in nearby Langtree. You didn't know that's where Edwards County is. It's rough country. Rough times. Bill Thurman loved every minute of it, and he taught his sons to love it right alongside him. The family had settled in at Kickapoo Springs on the west prong of the Nueces River. All the men managed to gain a section of land in the area, you know, most of which was still owned by railroad companies, original grants. And under the 50-cent Act of 1879, the land costed 50 cents an acre, and there was a limit of 640 acres. But you could get the prime bottom land because it was still available. Bill raised his sons in Edwards County. Joe is the oldest. He's a big man with dark skin and hazel eyes, named after his grandfather. He had a mean disposition and fly into the worst fits of temper you can imagine. Lazy and no good like his father, and gambled with his father. Later on, he married a widow woman named Texie. They had 2 children, but Joe beat them unmercifully. My daddy said he was born mean and never got over it. Burl came along next. Total opposite to his brother. Burl was slim, gray-blue eyes, blonde hair like his mother, always clean-shaven. A very gentle person who cared a great deal for his family. Burl married a beautiful girl named Eva Newton from Del Rio. They had 3 children together. The Thurmans never liked Eva. Said she was flighty. But Burl, he was his mother's favorite. He never forgot to bring her a small gift when he came from town. Unlike his brother Joe, Burl worked hard and owned land, but just like all the rest of them Thurman boys, Burl loved to gamble and race horses. And Burl, for some reason, just worshipped his older brother Joe. Sam was youngest of the 3, and he sort of balanced out the other 2. He was serious and fun-loving at the same time. Sam was always working somewhere. If he wasn't cowboying on a neighbor ranch or hauling freight from Brackettville, Sam would hunt the predators for skins and bounty. He loved his mother and sisters very much. He bought sewing materials for them in town. He even added a silver bracelet once for his favorite little sister. Of course, he got married too, but that's what's coming next in the story, which we got to get right into right now. In 1901, a new public school lands act passed. The government price was now set at $1.50 per acre, with a more generous limit of 2,500 acres available per person, because it was just grazing land. Financing was at 3%, no payments, 40 years. And at that point, the Zuber Bueller family came to Edwards County. They had money, ambition, and most importantly to this story, they didn't mind taking advantage of Bill Thurman's gambling and misfortune long enough to snag some of that prime land along the West Nueces River. Even with Bill's $11 per acre price tag, that parcel gave them access to water from the grazing lands and was a prime piece. The money went to just pay Bill's latest debts. As you might imagine, the Thurman clan took an instant disliking to the Zuberbuehlers. There was an incident. A school dance about a year later in November of 05, the holiday season was coming up fast. The Thurman clan went to Rock Springs for a big social event. The girls put on their hoop dresses and stood up in a trailer all the way there so there would be no wrinkles in them dresses. It soon came to light that one of Bill Thurman's boys, young Sam Thurman, had been talking with Miss Ellen Maddox. Her family was friends with the Zuberbuehlers, and Albert took it upon himself to approach Ellen's mother, a Mrs. Rachel Maddox, and he said, "You know the Thurmans are the sorriest people in the county, and none of your girls ought to keep company with them." Well, Rachel liked Mr. Albert, and she believed that he was talking to me that night as a friend. But Albert's warnings only antagonized the situation, of course. The young couple continued to see each other, you know, young love. Sam worked out at the Maddox place, and he rode off with Ellen in January. The incident was reported as an abduction in the papers, but it was actually an attempt at elopement. Either way, her brother had witnessed their departure and immediately alerted his father. They raised a group, or I might call them a posse, rush out and turn her back. Ellen returned home, at least for the moment. A few days later, Thurman brothers, including Sam and Burl and Joe, and they even had a friend named Tom Rimley, went hunting along the West Oasis River. Burl had run hogs on the land previously sold to Albert, and the group camped nearby with some other hunters, a group that included Johnny Zuberbuehler. You know, hogs tend to wander back to their old watering holes, so early the next morning on the 10th of February in the year of our Lord, 1906, Sam and Burl got up early and took their guns down to the river. According to Tom's later testimony, the boys left. Joe was making up bread. The shooting, there was some shots fired, and they broke around the thicket to where they could see it. The group heard Burl shout, "Don't do that, Albert, don't do that." Rimley heard a series of five or six more shots before getting around the thicket to find Sam Thurman and Johnny Zuberbuehler standing over Albert's dead body, cocked six-shooter still in his hand. Burl Thurman was coming up from the top of a ridge just across a small creek. The sheriff arrested Sam and Burl for the murder of Albert Zuberbuehler. And on the testimony of Johnny Zuberbuehler, who was also the county commissioner for that district, they pleaded self-defense and got released on a $5,000 bail. You know, as it stands, Sam and Ellen got married over that summer while they were still waiting for the trial. It came up in early September. Tempers were running high. Old Granddad Bill got arrested and fined for fighting right in the middle of the proceedings. Sam and Burl filed motions that influential persons were conspiring against them and wanted a change of venue. Judge refused, but then he changed his mind because the entire jewelry pool was used up in Sam's case. There just weren't enough men in Edwards County for another jury. Burl's trial would go to Kerrville in January. They tried to continue with Sam's case, but the jury was hung without a verdict. Of course it was. By that time, the county was just split right down the middle. Folks in the western part around Kickapoo Springs favored the Thurmans, while folks in Rock Springs favored the Zuberbuehler. Sam's new trial came up first. You know, it seemed obvious something was amiss, because Sam just sat there in the courtroom, cool as a cucumber, smoking cigarettes, totally unconcerned with the proceedings around him. And sure enough, stories this time were a little bit different. Well, now Tom Rimley remembered that Joe Thurman had exclaimed that Burl killed Albert. Earlier testimony had only indicated that they had killed Albert. The prosecutor was downright apoplectic, but he couldn't shake Tom's story. Instead, he found that yet another Thurman friend corroborated the new way of telling the story. Sam sat there, cool as a cucumber, smoking another cigarette. Now Sam was free. But Burl still had a problem. He got a continuance until June 27th and went home to Kickapoo Springs for what seemed like his last months of freedom. It was doubtful that a second jury would believe it when Tom's story changed back to implicate Sam instead of Burl, especially with Sam already acquitted. But then Burl got the typhoid fever and he died. His mother, Effie, broke down in tears and could barely get out the words when old Doc Robertson came by to see him. She pointed to the coffin and invited him to see the body. That wasn't necessary. He just needed a $210 fee, which was a huge fee for a doctor in those days. And he signed off on Burl's death. Funeral was held, and Burl was buried in the Thurman Cemetery. Effie, a couple of years later, was buried right alongside him. He was always her favorite. Trial was canceled. Case 551 was dismissed. The people would never know which of the brothers actually killed Albert Zuberbühler. We can believe it was the family sweetheart, Burl Thurman. You know, he certainly made a convenient target, being dead and all. Or we can believe that it was Sam Thurman. He was the one with all the motive, and yes, indeed, Sam was the one who got the girl. He might even be a third possibility, you know. Joe Thurman also had opportunity, and he was the first to point out the other two. He was mean. But all that was moved. Well, in a few years, the family started drifting apart. Sam went to Arizona and lived another 50 years. Ellen only made about half of that. Joe Thurman moved off to Macy. When his wife got sick, he brought her to my great-grandma's house and left her with instructions that if she died, they would have to help bury her because Joe was broke again. He finally moved off to Camp Wood. I don't know when he died. But then was Burl. You know, I only saw him one time after that, around 1922, I believe. Just a couple of years after the flu epidemic, yes, it was, Burl came to Thanksgiving dinner for a quick visit with great-grandpa Bill, who was now too old and sickly to go out hunting. I tried to ask Granny Laura about it once before she died, but all I got out of her was a smile. One of those little offhand remarks that the old ladies give you, you know, that maybe everything's not as it seems out there in Kickapoo Springs.
That is such a great story. Listen, we've got a little bit of extra time, and you've got another short tale that's about 2.5 minutes long, I know, that we originally, let's hear that one. Let's hear that one. I'm excited because that will really create a great package.
Okay, well, let's hear it. It's the story about Aunt Lena.
Yep.
And I'm very happy to have a few extra minutes here to tell you the story about her. She was Bill Thurman's older sister. In the years immediately after the Civil War, Joe had kept the family moving across North Texas. And while they were doing that, Lena married a fellow named Manning Davis. And the young couple started raising their family along the Pecan Bayou in Brown County. When they got married, they dropped off and weren't with Joe anymore. They weren't far from Gatesville, where a large group of very passionate ex-rebels ruled Coryell County with fear and bully tactics. They were determined to keep out all the ex-slaves and the Yankees. Lena considered them to be bad people, and even though many of them, including a son of the ringleader named Bill Ike Babb, were friends with the Thurman boys, but she strongly disapproved until something happened. While Manning was away, one night a huge rain came to Brown County. The family cabin was built on a high spot in the middle of a pecan bottom along the bayou, and as the water rose, Lena and her children found themselves cut off, surrounded by rising water that started to swirl around. The rain continued to fall. The water rise. Daylight came. Lena could see water swirling all around the little hill, lapping up at the sides. It was at least chest and shoulder deep, and Lena started to panic. A voice came to her across the bottom. Well, there was Bill Ike Babb, sitting on a horse about 150 yards away. He could see the trouble she was in, but without hesitation, Bill Ike rode right up into the floodwaters. Water was up to his saddle when he got to their cabin, and he carried those children to safety on his horse. He made a total of 3 trips back and forth. Horse was almost swimming. Lena rode behind him on the last run, baby in her arm. You know, after that, Lena changed her tune about Bill Ike Babb. She still didn't approve of how the Babb family ran things over in Gatesville, but never again, and I do mean never again, would anyone dare to say bad things about Bill Ike in her presence. You know, and that reminds me, there's just one little tidbit about Bill Ike Babb that I like to point out to people. He remained a friend of the Thurmans and followed them down to the Nueces River region, where he became a respected rancher. When he died, Bill Ike left the town of Langtry, which he now owned, with all of old Judge Roy Bean's saloon and courthouse to the state of Texas so it could become a historical site. So if you've been down there, Bill Ike made it happen. So it remains to this day that even Langtry was saved by Bill Ike Babb. And that's all
right. All right. I am so glad you said that. You know, you told us that story. You know, you tell these stories so effortlessly Wayne. It's really remarkable to me, because some people think that storytellers have to be dramatic. They have to be actors, they have to be theatrical. Not at all. They got to be regular people. And that's why at the beginning of the show, I said, ordinary people, not that you're ordinary, but regular people telling these extraordinary stories is what it's all about. And, you know, your stories are unique because they really do smack of a memoir. You know, autobiographies tell us about an entire life, but memoirs really spotlight significant moments, frozen in time, worth probing. And that's exactly what you do. You know, a lot of people, Wayne, will say to me, you know, I want to be able to tell stories about my family, but I just don't know how to start. What are a few tips you can offer them?
Think about who the people are and what and who do you want them to see, right? You need to describe these people. You need to let them get to know who these people are, and then you can tell them a few tidbits. And when I say tell them who they are, don't tell them just that they were born and they're 40 years old. Tell them what you know. Tell them what you know about their disposition, about their personalities, about kind of what made them.
Yeah, that makes really good sense. And you also kind of reinforce what I've always believed, and that is stories are not as much for the teller as they are for the listener, right? So you really want to describe these people, provide an in-depth persona, really paint a verbal picture for your listeners, but you have to know them first. You have to know who these people are first in order to find a way to communicate that imagery to your listeners. That's fantastic.
But, you know, the best word of advice I give anybody that wants to learn how to tell stories is tell stories that make you happy and that you're happy to tell, because people are going to feel that from you. They're going to feel that energy from you and they'll take it on. And sometimes sometimes they'll think they enjoyed a story they didn't even listen to.
You know, as boomers, we know that the civil rights movement, curious about this one, was one of the most important times in American history. I've taught college for over 40 years, and in recent years, my students never even heard of the 60s. They have no idea. And I know this was an important time to you, an important time to me. And there were a lot of inspirational moments, but just kind of, you know, detouring from family for a moment, what was the one moment or one event or time that stands out as especially inspirational to you?
Oh, goodness. From the civil rights era?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Could be a song. Anything. Just curious.
Well, you know, I'm just a tad young for it, but I do remember very much. I was in the seventh grade and I was riding to school on a motorcycle. And of course, we had had the buses had come in. Dothan, Alabama was one of the last places to give in and let the buses happen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tried everything. We'd lost every court case. And the buses finally happened. All these people, some of them I knew, these parents, were on the other side of the street yelling and screaming at these kids as they got off the bus. And it was just the awfulest. It was the awfulest scene. I don't know. It did hit me pretty hard.
Yeah.
As far as the scene in the civil rights area was to literally witness that.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate you thinking about this because, you know, that era really prompted a lot of stories for me, at least later on in life. Right now I'm a docent at the Holocaust Museum. A lot of people know that. I talk about that on a lot of these shows. And, you know, it's really an extension of human rights and the idea of thinking about human rights still being an issue today, meaning how can we still hate? You know, why do we still see differences as being significant? Why do we see differences as being constraints rather than blessings? Doesn't sound very profound, but it's one of those lessons. Yeah.
You know, you can say, why do we still feel that way? But if you take a look at how we were 200 years ago as a race, as a human race, not just the United States, and then 100 years ago, and you see where society is in terms of, it used to be all about strongest survive, dominate the weak. Over the past 200 years, we have shifted this focus. We're no longer really focused on the strong dominating the weak. It's a long process for humanity to literally change that.
Right.
I think we're on the right road.
Yeah.
But I'm an optimist.
I agree with that. I think we have to look at times in history in order to really gauge currency and what's happening now. But that's a great point. a great point. Let me ask you another question. I'm curious. Okay. You're showing me a couple of
bottles. Showing off my Made in the USA Barack Obama. But
how do you know when you tell a story? I know you're just getting into this art, but when you tell a story, how do you know if it goes over well?
The people paid attention to me. If I held their attention,
mm-hmm.
And you can usually see, you know, if you can see them, you can tell if they're paying attention to you. And if I've held their attention, then it was a good story.
Right. It resonates. You bet. Thank you. Thank you, Wayne Lynch, for your stories laced with history and warmth. I just really, really love your stories, and I want you back.
Oh, well,
I hope everybody.
I got another great group from out there in West Texas, man. Those West Texas Germans. We got to get into that something.
All right. Everybody, stay put for Living Art, hosted by Michael Woodson, another KPFT exclusive. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and be sure to join us every Wednesday at 6 for So What's Your Story? You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek. And along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't end happily, it doesn't mean you can't live happily ever after. Peace.
Houston's community station since 1970. This is KPFT.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Hikers who venture high into the mountains are sometimes rewarded with a view of sparkling turquoise alpine lakes. These vibrant hues are made possible by glaciers. As glaciers erode, they grind down the rock below them, creating a fine sediment that's commonly called rock flour.
So the turquoise-ish appearance of those alpine lakes comes from the eroded rock material that pours into them from melting glaciers.
Rolf Feinbrook of the University of Alberta studies alpine lakes in Canada. He says as the climate warms and glaciers melt away, the lake's source of rock flour disappears. As a result, many lakes that were turquoise as late as the mid-20th century are now a clear blue. It's not just a color change. Without the rock flour, sunlight penetrates deeper into the lake, allowing more algae to grow. It also makes the water warmer. Scientists are still studying how this phenomenon will change the lake's ecosystems. But Feinbrook says the loss of the lake's turquoise color is a powerful visual reminder of the effects of climate change.
So it's just one other line of evidence suggesting that we're changing the world at a far too rapid pace.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit Climate Connections.